welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. On this week's show...
First, I want to thank everyone in this city who went to the polls tonight and sent a message loud and clear. This is your city.
We bring you a special episode looking at the re-election of Mayor Bill de Blasio in New York. This Tuesday, de Blasio became the first Democrat to win re-election for City Hall since Mayor Ed Koch 32 years ago. His first term was marred by investigations into his fundraising, arguments with fellow Democrat governor Andrew Cuomo over ongoing issues with the subway system, a rise in homelessness, and opposing the national policies of President Donald Trump. So, as he enters his second term with a promise to continue to fight for fairness, we ask what are the issues at hand that need to be addressed and how New York has changed under his watch. That's all coming up in the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. New York's Democratic mayor may have coasted to re-election earlier this week, but he still has unfinished business. And while his campaign slogan of A Tale of Two Cities, highlighting issues of inequality, has been replaced with This Is Your City, he's still to realise his goal of creating a more affordable, inclusive Big Apple. What is sure is that nothing will be easy in a metropolis still carved up by developers. Our New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker reports.
Well, you wanted 4 more years, you got 4 more years. First, I want to thank everyone in this city who went to the polls tonight and sent a message loud and clear. This is your city.
Your city may be a nifty campaign slogan that speaks of inclusiveness, but it's not always easy in a city where the issue of affordability is always threatening to bubble up to the surface. Although New York's newly re-elected mayor may seem more comfortable talking about Donald Trump these days, those old chestnuts from the start of his mayorship, namely housing and the cost of living, still continue to dog him.
It is just as important to preserve an affordable unit, to make sure it's clean and safe and good for a family, and keep it affordable. That is just as important as building a new unit.
For writer and editor Kai Wright, the reason it proves such a central theme is obvious.
This is something that touches literally everybody in the city. It just does. You know, it's part of all of our lives. And we all have really strong feelings about it. Most of those feelings are, at best, limitedly informed and often misinformed, because we know a lot about our piece of the puzzle. You know about your life as a renter. You know about your life as someone who has been displaced. You know about your life as a homebuyer. You know about your life as a developer.
Wright hosted a recent podcast, a joint venture between WNYC Public Radio and The Nation, looking at the effects of gentrification in Brooklyn, called There Goes the Neighborhood.
There goes the neighborhood.
Part of the issue is the fact that there simply isn't enough affordable or rent-stabilized stock to go around in such a cramped city, meaning de Blasio has inherited a problem that has long been referred to as a housing emergency.
We've always had that problem, but there's always been a stock of middle-income or low-income housing to go around. And we've entered into a time now where, for a whole host of reasons, you really only have two housing markets. You have the luxury housing market, and you have a way overtaxed poverty housing market. And there's very little in between.
Kai Wright again. De Blasio's answer? Build his way out of the problem by rezoning 15 neighborhoods, allowing the developers in while making sure they include affordable housing in their plans. Through it, de Blasio recently announced he would meet the goal he set himself of building or preserving 200,000 below market rate apartments by the end of 2022, 2 years ahead of schedule. An answer to the problem, sure, but also one that arguably opens the door to gentrification. One of the front lines of development and affordability is the Brooklyn neighborhood of Sunset Park, a noisy waterfront quarter on the borough's western flank.
So when we talk about gentrification, we talk about displacement and like who benefits and who loses. And that is the key question.
Janae Foster is a coordinator at UpRose, a grassroots community organization from Sunset Park.
In communities like Sunset Park, low-income communities of color, we have often been burdened and left out of political decisions and making sure that our community gets what it needs. So gentrification is really about who benefits. Like, people talk about job creation and bringing more jobs into a community through rezonings. But what we ask is, does the community actually benefit from that? Do local residents actually get employed?
UpRose wants to protect the industrial nature of the waterfront from high-rise condos and other new developments that could be detrimental to the local population. The organization's aim is to keep manufacturing and other industries while working to make sure they become cleaner and greener. Down the road, though, there's a sign of what may be to come. If you needed a sign of how this neighborhood was changing, then it may just be here at Industry City, where I'm standing at the moment. Now, there's an odd juxtaposition. For example, you may be able to hear the rumble of cars going past. I'm standing right by the BQE, an expressway, an elevated highway, essentially. I've just passed a load of auto shops selling everything from new glass to wax jobs for your vehicle. And now I'm at this set of warehouses that is Industry City, a place that's undergone rapid change in recent years and has lured a creative set to this neighborhood. Outside the building, I can see banners advertising creative space. I've actually just walked past a cafe with an A-board outside advertising espressos, and with a couple of bikes inside hanging from the walls. And just here further up, there's a food hall at Industry City where you can get, among other things, avocado on toast. On 3rd Avenue, not far from the gargantuan Industry City complex, is a cluster of small businesses.
My name is Alberto Vergara. I'm the owner of Cotton Hustle, a small business, and we do screen printing. I've lived in Sunset my whole life. I was born and raised here. I'm starting to see like a lot of new faces. A lot of like friends that I grew up with have moved away just because it's harder for them to really stay here. And there's just other states and other places that it's a lot more economical for them to live. In terms of rent, I think it's affecting businesses the same way. It's getting harder for them to stay here and like keep their doors open when there's places with a lot lower rent. I have been affected by the rent going up, but we're doing what we could to just keep it going and stuff. We've been growing gradually, so that's good.
And are people he knows being forced out due to high home rentals too?
I hear it all the time. People's rent going up. There are people that try to like fight back a little bit and try to get some sort of like rental freeze on it, but even that's kind of hard. A friend recently just told me of his story, and they're actually going to court to try to get a rental freeze.
There is no magic wand, no formula to stop development pushing out the people who have the least as it gets more expensive. It's replicated in urban metropolises, not just in the US, but throughout the world. Certainly, de Blasio is taking on a problem decades in the making, and to give him his dues, he's clearly trying to do something about it. But for Kai Wright, maybe the whole issue needs a radical rethink.
We have built our housing market around developers instead of around people, and around investments instead of around homes. And that is an active choice that we have made, that policymakers have made. And I think the solution is we need to all of us get to a place where we understand that's a choice our elected officials have made, and we need to make different choices if we're going to have livable communities.
In a city where the developer remains king, though, that community ideal may be more of a pipe dream for now. Don't make the same mistake. Let's go.
New York is anything but stagnant, and as we've just heard, no matter where you turn, a new crane is towering over the skyline, or an old building is coming down. While it may seem chaotic at first, the way the city changes is deeply connected to the policies and practices of those leading it. Monocle's Charles McFarlane caught up with New York Magazine architecture critic Justin Davidson to talk about how the city is being developed, struggling retail, and what Mayor de Blasio can do in his new term to help preserve, but also shape a city for the future.
I'm a walker. I like walking around the city and, you know, discovering things about it. And doing that and being an architecture critic gives you a kind of like close-up view of both how the city's changed and also how it stays the same. Because that tension is something I tried to get into a book I wrote that came out of that experience of walking around. It's called Magnetic City, A Walking Companion to New York. And it's a set of itineraries that takes you through the city of the past, the city of the present that you're physically walking through, and a kind of projection into the future. And what strikes me about that is how the speed of the change that the city is going through always feels like it's breakneck. It always feels like it's as crazy and out of control as it's ever been. And that's been true for almost the entire history of the city. So we look up now and we see cranes everywhere and buildings going up, and it feels like the city's spinning out of control. And if you look back, something that became very vivid to me as I was researching this book, you see that in the 1840s, people felt that the old city was being wiped away and the city that they had grown up with was ruined, and it was becoming a place only to make money with no character. And we're now many generations beyond that, and many of those new things have not only become old, but in turn been wiped away. And so that sense of fear and excitement binding together on every block is really a constant of New York's history. And it's really one of the things that makes it so exciting and makes being up close and observing the city exciting on a day-to-day basis.
I think for many New Yorkers, de Blasio seemed like a real departure from the previous mayor, Bloomberg. Now, in practice, I think it seems a little bit more nuanced than that.
Yeah, I'd say that on a lot of issues, especially those having to do with development and the physical city and the growth of, you know, the city itself, there's been a real departure in tone, not that much of a departure in policy. De Blasio has pushed affordable housing as the centerpiece of his economic development policy. But the tools he's using are the same as those the previous mayors have used, which is basically to incentivize and in some cases require developers to include some affordable housing, you know, 20% in market rate buildings, and then also to build other 100% affordable. But the era in which government was building large amounts of housing for low-income people, you know, that is long gone. So all of this is filtered through the market. And that's essentially the same as was true before. He's increased that program, but not by orders of magnitude. It's incremental. So, you know, that's the big push. On many other things, I think the path was largely set before, and that's being extended. So, for instance, with bike paths, the network of bicycle paths in the city has been growing, and de Blasio has continued to lengthen it and to, you know, fill it in at a steady clip. But the idea of transforming the streets from car-dominated roadways to places that were being shared by bikes and pedestrians and lots of other people, that was really pretty much the theory for that. And the impulse was the product of the Bloomberg administration.
Now, we've definitely seen a lot of development over the years, especially with skyscrapers and a lot of apartments going up. But as far as retail on the street, that seems to be disappearing. Is there any way to save that, you think, in the city?
You know, retail has its own dynamics, and the dynamics in the city are related to but not the same as the dynamics for the rest of the country. I mean, obviously there's pressure from online retailers that makes itself felt in different ways in different neighborhoods. So, you know, I think we're probably going to see more restaurants, which are not outsourceable to online giants. We may see, as some of the big bricks and mortar retailers get pushed out by online retailers, we may see some of those storefronts being filled in by, you know, really local, smaller retail, the kind that the big giants of bricks and mortar retail pushed out 10, 15, 20 years ago. So I think we may see some of that cycling back, but I think that we're going to need to be inventive and sensitive about how to plan over the long term for that balance, because basically the city is zoned, much of the city is zoned, to include retail at street level. That's how buildings are conceived. And if there isn't a demand for that space, then we have to figure out what to do with that space. And that is a major design, planning, economic, political, long-term problem that requires some vision and some ideas of what the alternatives are going to be. You know, in the short term, I think I don't see the politics being favorable for passing any kind of legislation that protects retail, that protects rents, for instance. You know, I think that's tough, but if retail is falling and the demand for that space is falling, then those rents are going to go down.
Do you think there's any room for zoning in the city to be overhauled?
Ideally, in an ideal world, we would really sort of start a multi-year process of looking at every aspect of New York's zoning law and overhaul it to match the society and the city that we actually live in and the one that's being projected for the future. You know, right now we have these ancient layers, sedimentary layers of legislation that accumulate, that never get wiped out, and that have all kinds of distorting effects. So there are plenty of areas, for instance, where you can't build buildings as high as the buildings that are already there because the old buildings exceed the later zoning. We have strictures over whether you can have, say, commercial uses on top of residential ones. So you can put retail on the ground floor, but you can't really put it anywhere else in a residential area. So the zoning makes it very difficult, for instance, to have multi-use buildings or complexes where you have what you have, say, at Time Warner Center, which is offices and hotels and residences and retail and restaurants all combined together into one building. Those kinds of things are difficult to do. And so we have all kinds of good protections that zoning offers, and then an outrageous tangle of regulations that makes it difficult to do things that we actually want to be able to do.
Do you see this being on the front burner when de Blasio comes in for his second term?
De Blasio's approach to economic development and to the future development of the city is to solve immediate problems as best he can in small ways, incremental ways, and then to call them large-scale victories when they're not. I don't see him doing anything that isn't really solvable or at least majorly addressable in the short term. This kind of overhaul of the zoning, the problem, one reason it doesn't get done is because it's, first of all, a little abstract for most voters to really understand. And also, what's the political payoff? You know, there's so many people who have entrenched interests in the zoning being the way it is, and others who would rush in to try to bend and twist it to serve their personal interests. So it's opening up a huge can of worms, and something I don't see a politician, certainly not one like de Blasio, really tackling.
So what do you think will be on the front burner for him coming in for the new administration as far as development?
Although he casts himself as, you know, a progressive and liberal, and although he says he would like to impose a great deal of regulation and, you know, try to get the city the most involved in development, I think ultimately there's a kind of laissez-faire attitude, and how development happens will follow the cycles of the market. So I don't see him laying out long-term visions into which the market has to flow. I don't see him, for instance, building large-scale parks that would then stimulate development around them. I think that he's more likely to figure out where the housing should go and then kind of put in public space and parks almost as an afterthought You know, I think that ultimately he's not willing to challenge the needs of the real estate industry and of developers. He made a big deal about changing the zoning to mandate more affordable housing. But the way, the mechanics of the way that happened is still ultimately down to developers' interests. So this is still a city, as it almost always has been, where private interests lead and in some way the government follows when it comes to economic development. So what I don't see is a vision for the future, particularly in areas where really government has to lead. And one example of that is, you know, that it's fine to keep building bike lanes, but we're at a point in the development of the urban world where we really need to be thinking well beyond that. You know, what is this experience of walking down the street going to be in 2050, in 2100? Those are things that we need to plan for. And I think partly it's, you know, the pressures of large numbers of pedestrians as the city's population continues to grow. Partly it's the technology of driverless cars. It's going to be the economics, the nature of the people and the businesses that congregate in cities. All of these things place tremendous pressure on how we use the streets. It is no longer tenable, and it certainly won't be a few years from now, to think of the streets as primarily arteries for cars to drive down with people trying to crowd as best they can, hugging the buildings. That's not the future. That's the past. And unless we really kind of have government that leads the way on figuring out how to integrate all those things and how to redesign the streets, not just for today and not just for, like, you know, next week, but long term, because everything about the city's development will be shaped by some of those decisions. And I don't see them happening.
That was Justin Davidson, architecture critic for New York Magazine. Now, Rob Rogers founded Rogers Partners, Architects and Urban Designers in 2013, largely focusing on architecture and public spaces. But on top of a range of work that includes a new pier in St. Petersburg, Florida, Rogers has also carved out a name for his firm exploring the issue of cities and security, an aspect of design that seems more relevant than ever given the recent vehicle terrorist attack in the city. He's worked on streetscape design in Battery Park and financial district areas of Manhattan, including functional but attractive bollards and intuitive adjustments to traffic patterns to help reduce the risk of a threat. And he spoke to Ed Stocker.
The focus for so long has been on buildings and buildings as forms, but in fact, so much of our city life, and certainly our urban life, is in all of the spaces in between. And we've always been interested in the quality of the pedestrian experience, the urban experience. Why is it that people like to be in cities? It's because of the busyness, the curiosity, the attraction, the fascination. I grew up in Colorado, but I love New York. I think it's important when people come and visit here because they actually have to touch each other, you know, and that's what makes urban life fabulous. But those concentrations of population, of wealth, of power and control also mean that you're setting up targets for other kinds of situations. We got involved really after 9/11, initially down in Battery Park City, where the nexus of American Express, Merrill Lynch, and the Mercantile Exchange were there, and obviously right next to the site of the Trade Center, and particularly concerned about the vulnerability of buildings to vehicle-borne attack. And the challenge really then is, how do you maintain this quality of life, the pedestrianization, the delight of being on the street, when in fact there's a new layer of protective demands? We got involved in Battery Park City in a great way. It's like a terrific urban laboratory. It always has been. You know, it's completely fabricated ground built in the river on fill, master planned to be a mixed-use community. And as it got built out over time, things like the security requirements changed, but also our knowledge of the delight and pleasure of street life adapted and grew as well. And so it was really trying to mold all those things together that started our work in the realm of security. And because Battery Park City is interesting as an independent authority, Department of Transportation, Department of Police, city planning, they're all there by invitation. It's a little bit different than actually city-owned property. And so it made it a really particularly great place to try and experiment. So what we got into was trying to understand how the overlap of high quality urban design could include security at the same time. So we actually began to investigate things like, if we changed pedestrian crossings even a block away from a perceived target, could those crossings, by becoming essentially elevated roadways, neck downs, they would be things that would affect a potential vehicle attack. Therefore, you're not just trying to say, oh, I'm going to make one protective line. You're actually thinking about it comprehensively and in terms of the quality of life. So we developed a series of strategies that were near the building perimeter, but we also developed strategies that were further away that actually mitigated the threat while creating spaces that you want to have and places that you want to be.
So is that the whole idea, that you don't want people to realize what their true function is, or it has a double function?
Well, there are very different opinions about that. If you go down there, you'll see that all around the Goldman Sachs building are big stainless steel bollards that are 3.5 feet high and they're 4 feet apart. And, you know, we worked with them to try and talk about whether they would be included in this more comprehensive study. And they wanted to appear as defensive as possible. The psychology there was, I want to look like I'm the hardest guy around. And that's one of the difficulties, because you inevitably end up with almost a competitive situation, because then will somebody turn and go the other way? And we worked with a series of really sophisticated consultants, also dealing with NYPD's counterterrorism division. And I think in the end, when you're talking about permanent measures, then you're really talking about a relatively sophisticated attack being thwarted or mitigated, as opposed to an incidental incident in which is so difficult to provide protection for those kinds of things. Some of it is a mindset. You know, at the time, we had a really sophisticated governmental agencies that were really interested in the quality of the public realm, you know, from the policy side, from the political side. And so the environment was right for experimentation and testing of these kinds of strategies. I think there's kind of two approaches to that. One is make it obvious but invisible to the pedestrian experience. And I think that's the track we always tried to follow, which is, if you were trying to plan an attack on something, it would be obvious to you that there's levels of defensive measures, whether it's a bollard per se, which I don't like so much because it's singular, both in its response and what it is. But then there's also, like along Route 9A, we dealt with planted areas, changes in elevation, stepped walls, using things where two things in combination produce a level of protection rather than just some singular element. And that sort of sophistication is apparent to some kind of planner, but you can design it so that the experience of a pedestrian, a cyclist, a visitor, a tourist, is not evident. It doesn't look like a protective realm. I mean, across the street at the World Trade Center, you see rings and rings of bollards. And I believe that that sends a message of fear, actually. And it changes your experience of the street. It changes your experience of a public space. So the role of design, which is what we bring to the table, is to say, we can produce that level of protection, but we can also produce the quality of public space, the character of life and lifestyle. That is why you want to be in a concentration and density and in a city in the first place.
Now, obviously, New York has had a recent attack on the west side of Manhattan, plans to put up protection there on the cycleway. What do you make of that?
You know, I think there are long stretches of that cycleway that are protected, and that was a really particular instance where it was not. And I think we have to be positive, optimistic. We also have to be realistic. And the chance that you're going to reduce all risk, you're just not. There will be places, and it doesn't make an excuse for an attack. But I do think you have an effort to look at the city as a whole in terms of our spaces and qualities and areas. And there are places where you obviously should provide protection because of the iconic nature of the sites or the obviousness of pedestrian concentrations, but it needs to be done both holistically in a conversation citywide. What are those key areas? Where do we actually make investments of energy and attention? And what are the areas where the incidence, likelihood of incidence is sufficiently remote that it probably doesn't make sense to expend resources throughout.
Providing 1.75 billion rides a year, New York City has one of the busiest subway systems in the world. But now it seems that cracks are starting to show in the 113-year-old system. While ridership is at record highs, the system has become bogged down in chronic delays, infuriating New Yorkers. While subways operated by the Metropolitan Transit Authority may be controlled by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, the lagging system is surely at the top of re-elected Mayor de Blasio's to-do list. Charles McFarlane reports.
That garbled voice coming over a train's PA system has become an all too common sound for New York City strap hangers over the past months. What started as the summer from hell, as Governor Andrew Cuomo dubbed it, of subway repairs, has turned into a fall of near daily subway delays, track fires, and sardine-like packed trains. While it certainly caught the attention and frustration of many New Yorkers, there seems to be little light at the end of the tunnel. On the packed platform of the 59th Street station of the A, B, C, and D lines, I was able to hear some of the gripes of New Yorkers struggling to get to work on time. Have you been experiencing a lot of delays over the past couple months?
Yes, almost daily.
Has it been getting worse and worse, or do you think it's getting a little bit better maybe?
It's the same. It's not getting better or worse.
How long have you been commuting in the city?
For 14 years.
And you think it's worse now than it was when you started commuting?
Yes, 100%.
Getting stuck in tunnels a lot. What lines do you take?
I take the 2, 3, A, C, B, D, 4, 5, 6, and I have to catch this train.
Well, I take the 1 train primarily, and I frequently have to wait for 2 trains to go by in order to get on one and get to work in the morning. It seems to be getting worse. My impression is that the ridership has increased significantly in the past at least 5 years.
In general, overall has been fine for me, honestly. Today has been a desperate... I mean, there are certain days, as we know, which where we have these delays which really frustrates people and myself. So, but statistically, I'm not very sure if... there more than last year, for example. And if you look in historical perspective, it's extraordinary. I need to go.
Okay.
All right.
Right. Thank you. While these New Yorkers were eventually able to board their morning trains, it is hard not to see the system is at a tipping point. What can be done to fix the ailing system, and what role can Mayor de Blasio play in its rehabilitation? I was able to ask Tom Wright, president of the Regional Plan Association, but not before getting stuck in the subway myself.
Tom Wright, president of Regional Plan Association, RPA as we refer to ourselves, is a think tank, a research-based advocacy organization that's been around for 95 years now, creating long-range plans for the tri-state metropolitan region around New York City.
First off, maybe you could fill us in a little bit of how the subway system got to the state it's in. Just coming down here, I got stuck, so maybe go into a little bit of the history of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's for those of us who've been working on this for decades, seeing the sudden attention to the subway system over the last couple months, I mean, what really happened was the system has reached this breaking point, which was predictable and predicted by many of us. What we're seeing now is the effects of a system that was kind of generally working okay, but we weren't adding capacity to the system to keep up with the growth of the city and the metropolitan region. In the last half dozen years, New York City has added something like 600,000 jobs and over 500,000 new residents. And so year after year, we were seeing increased ridership. With the Metro card introduced about 20 years ago, people started to ride with the unlimited cards. They rode more on the weekends. They rode more off-peak. And all of that was good. But what we were doing was we weren't adding to the capacity of the system. And we now have a system that just cannot keep up with all of the growth of demand and the number of people who want to ride it. And what happens is when parts of the system, because of the demand on it, when little pieces of it break down, when delays start to happen on the Lex line or on the Broadway line, they get compounded because the system doesn't have any redundancy, it doesn't have any resiliency, it doesn't have any excess capacity to kind of do a workaround when something breaks down. Instead, what happens is that a small delay, a small problem in one piece of the system cascades to the rest of it. And that's what we're seeing today.
So what, if anything, could Mayor de Blasio do in a second term of office? He sort of seems to have come under a lot of fire, but it's really not all at his feet, is it?
That's correct. Look, we're all wondering about the second term because of the way the election played out. He didn't have to make many commitments. He didn't have to talk too much about these issues or give any specifics. And so to some degree, it's a blank slate for his second term. And those of us in the advocacy, in the civic community, in the business community are all going to be looking to try to see if we can now put some meat on the bones and get him to follow through on things. But the truth is, the subways are essentially run by the state government. They are part of the MTA, and it's the governor who appoints the plurality of board members on the MTA, selects the CEO and chairman of the MTA, and has most control over the budget of the MTA. So the governor is really the person with the main levers. But that said, the mayor still has levers and influence that he should be using. He has appointees to the MTA board. And in particular, right now, there's a very lively debate going on about additional resources for the MTA. The mayor has proposed a surcharge on millionaires' income to try and pay for it, knowing that that's not really going anywhere in Albany in the legislature. The governor has proposed, I think, a better idea, which is to charge vehicles entering Manhattan south of 60th Street. Now, we haven't seen any of the details of the governor's proposal, but so far the mayor has been resisting that. And that's surprising to a lot of us in the transit advocacy world.
You look far beyond, you know, every 4 years. You have a bigger vision. What are you looking for? What are you looking to see in the next 4 years that, you know, maybe can happen, or maybe what you're a little wary of?
Well, I'll say, look, in the next 4 years, we could see modern technology introduced on the subways for fare collection, which makes it easier to transfer, makes it easier to pay, would speed up everybody's trip through those turnstiles. And I know it doesn't seem like, you know, but a few seconds here or there actually add up when you're talking about some 6 million trips a day. In 4 years, I'd like to see a regional congestion charging scheme put into place where people would be paying to drive into Manhattan south of 60th Street, and that would be generating billions of dollars that would start to go into capital construction and maintenance of these systems so that we would be delivering new signal technology and ordering new cars and other things that we just can't afford right now. So those are the exciting things that I think could happen.
As de Blasio settles in for his second term at Gracie Mansion, the fate of the subway system seems to be as delayed as ever. But the trains that millions of New Yorkers depend on daily must continue to function, and while the mayor may not be solely responsible for the shortfalls, he'll have to help get them sorted nonetheless.
And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rabello and our team in New York. Ed Stocker and Charles McFarlane produced all of these reports. Our thanks to them. And our sound engineer, well, that was David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Barbara Streisand with New York State of Mind. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.